first bell before leaving, but with the monarchs roosting all around, I felt safe enough. I mounted up and started pedaling slowly toward the gate in the wall. After half an hour or so, the morning bell sounded. This close to the city, it was very loud. The monarchs rose in a great wave of black and gold, heading south. I watched them go, wishing I were going that way myself, to Dora's, then to the tunnel entrance, then back into my own world of computers and magic steel birds that flew in the air. But, just as the poem says, I had miles to go and promises to keep. At least the night soldiers are gone, I thought. Back to their crypts and mausoleums, because that's where things like them sleep. There was no way I could know that for sure, but I did. 6. We reached the gate in less than an hour. I'd dismounted the trike. Overhead, the clouds were lower and darker than ever, and I didn't think the rain could hold off for much longer. My estimate that the gray wall was 40 feet high turned out to be way wrong. It was 70, at least, and the gate was titanic. It was faced in gold, real gold, I was sure, not paint, and almost as long as a football field. The staves bracing it leaned this way and that, but not from age and decay. I was sure they had been placed that way, making strange angles. They made me think of Lovecraft again, and the mad non-Euclidean universe of monsters that was always straining to overwhelm ours. It wasn't just the angles that were disturbing. Those staves were of some cloudy green substance that looked like a kind of metallic glass. Something seemed to be moving in them, like black vapor. It made my stomach feel funny. I looked away, and when I looked back, the black stuff was gone. When I turned my head and looked at the staves from the corner of my eye, the black stuff seemed to return. Vertigo swept through me. Not wanting to lose what little breakfast I'd eaten, I looked down at my feet, and there, on one of the cobblestones, printed in paint that might once have been blue but had faded to gray, were the initials A.B. My head cleared, and when I looked up, I just saw the gate, crisscrossed by those green supports. But what a gate it was, like a CGI effect out of an epic movie. But this was no special effect. I wrapped my knuckles on one of the cloudy green staves, just to be sure. I wondered what would happen if I tried Claudia's name on the gate, or Stephen Woodley's. They were both of the royal blood, weren't they? The answer was yes, but if I understood correctly, I wasn't sure I did because I've never been good at untangling familial relationships, only Princess Leah was the heir apparent to the throne of Empis. Or maybe it was the throne of the Galleons. It didn't matter to me, as long as I could get in. If the name didn't work, I was going to be stuck out here, and Radar would die. Stupid Charlie actually looked for an intercom, the sort of thing you'd find beside the doorway of an apartment building. There was no such thing, of course, just those weird crisscrossing staves with impenetrable blackness between them. I muttered, "Leah of the Galleon." Nothing happened. Not loud enough, maybe, I thought. But shouting seemed wrong in the silence outside the wall, almost like spitting on a church altar. Do it anyway. Outside the city, it's probably safe enough. Do it for Radar. In the end, I couldn't bring myself to shout, but I cleared my throat and raised my voice. Open in the name of Leah of the Galleon. I was answered by an inhuman scream that made me step back and almost fall over the front of the trike. You know that saying, my heart was in my mouth? Mine felt like it was ready to bolt out from between my lips, run away, and leave me dead on the ground. The screaming went on, and I realized it was the sound of some titanic machine starting up after years or decades. perhaps not since Mr. Bowditch had last used this world's version of open sesame. The gate trembled. I saw those black tendrils writhing and rising in the off-kilter green staves. There was no doubt about them this time. It was like looking at sediment in a shaken bottle. The screech of the machinery changed to a rattling thunder, and the gate started to move to the left along what must have been a huge hidden track. I watched it slide by, and the vertigo returned worse than ever. I turned away, drunk staggered 4 steps to the seat of Claudia's trike, and put my face down on it. My heart was slamming in my chest, my neck, even in the sides of my face. I couldn't look at those ever-changing angles as the gate opened. I thought I'd pass out if I did, or see something so awful it would send me fleeing back the way I'd come, leaving my dying dog behind. I closed my eyes and reached out for a handful of her fur. "Hold on," I thought. "Hold on, hold on, hold on." 7. At last, the clattering rumble stopped. There was another of those protesting screeches, and silence returned. Returned? It fell like an anvil. I opened my eyes and saw Radar looking at me. I opened my hand and saw I'd pulled out a considerable swatch of her hair, but she hadn't complained. Maybe because she had greater pains to contend with, but I don't think that was it. I think she realized I needed her. "Okay," I said. "Let's see what we've got." Ahead of me, inside the gate, was a vast tiled courtyard. It was lined with the remains of great stone butterflies on both sides, each on a pedestal and standing 20 feet high. Their wings had been broken and lay in piles on the courtyard floor. They made a kind of passageway. I wondered if, once upon a better time, each of those monarch butterflies, for of course that was what they were, had represented a king or queen in the line of Galleon. The screaming started up again, and I realized the gate was preparing to roll shut. Leah's name might open it again, it might not. I had no intention of finding out. I mounted up and pedaled inside as the gate began to rumble shut. The rubber wheels whispered on the tiles, which had once been colorful but were now faded. "Everything turning gray," I thought. "Gray or that sick shade of cloudy green." The butterflies, perhaps once colorful, but now as gray as everything else, loomed over us as we passed beneath and between. Their bodies were intact, but the faces, as well as the wings, had been battered off. It made me think of videos I'd seen of ISIS destroying ancient statues, artifacts, and temples they considered blasphemous. We came to a double arch in the shape of butterfly wings. Something had been written above it, but that too had been battered. All that remained were the letters L.I. My first thought was Lillimar, the name of the city, but it could have been Galleon. Before going through the arch, I looked back to check on Radar. We had to be quiet. Each of the people I'd met made that point in his or her own way, and I didn't think that was going to be a problem with raids. She was asleep again. Which was good in one way, and worrisome in another. The arch was damp and smelled of ancient decay. On the other side was a circular pool faced in lichen-encrusted stone. Perhaps once the water in that pool had been a cheerful blue. Perhaps once people had come here to sit on its stone coping, eating their midday meals while watching the empessarian version of ducks or swans go gliding. Mothers might have held their children out so they could paddle their feet. Now there were no birds and no people. If there had been, they would have steered clear of that pool as if it were poison, because that's what it looked like. The water was an opaque, viscous green that appeared almost solid. The vapor arising from it was indeed mephitic, what I imagined the stench of a tomb stuffed with decaying bodies would smell like. Surrounding it was a curving walkway, just barely big enough for the three-wheeler. On one of the tiles, to the right, were Mr. Bowditch's initials. I started that way, then stopped and looked back, certain I'd heard something. The shuffle of a footstep, or maybe the whisper of a voice. "Pay no mind to voices you may hear," Claudia had said. Now I heard nothing, and nothing moved in the shadows of the arch I'd come through. I pedaled slowly along the right side curve of the stinking pool. On the far side was another butterfly arch. As I neared it, a drop of rain fell on the back of my neck. Then another. They began to dot the pool, making brief craters on its surface. As I looked, something black emerged from it just for a second or two, then it disappeared. I didn't get a good look, but I'm pretty sure I saw the momentary gleam of teeth. The rain began to come down harder. Soon it would be a torrent. Once in the shelter of the second arch, I dismounted and spread the blanket over my sleeping dog. Musty and moth-eaten or not, I was very glad I'd brought it. 8. Because I was ahead of schedule, I hoped that I could linger for a while in the shelter of this arch, hoping the rain would let up. I didn't want to take Raids out in it, even with the blanket to cover her. Only how long was a while? 15 minutes? 20? And just how was I supposed to tell? I'd become used to checking my phone for the time, and wished bitterly for Mr. Bowditch's watch. It came to me as I stared at the rain sheeting down on what looked like a deserted business street crammed with green-fronted shops, that I had become too used to my phone, period. My dad had a saying about computer-driven gear.
"Let a man get used to walking on a crutch, and he can't walk without it."
The shops were on the far side of a dry channel. They looked to be the sort of places well-to-do people would visit, like an antique version of Rodeo Drive or the Oak Street District in Chicago. From where I was, I could read one gold-plated, surely not solid gold, sign that read, "His Majesty's Bootery." There were show windows from which the glass had been broken long ago. Many rains had driven the shards into the gutters, and in the middle of the street, curled like the body of a never-ending snake, was what had to be a trolley wire. Something had been engraved on the paving just outside the arch where we were sheltering. I got on my knees for a close look. Most of it had been battered away like the wings and faces of the butterflies, but when I ran my fingers over the beginning and the end, I thought I could make out G-A and A-D. The letters between might have been anything, but I thought maybe this main thoroughfare, which had been Kingdom Road outside the wall, became Galleon Road inside. Whatever it was, it led straight toward the high buildings and green towers of the central city. Three spires stood higher than the rest, their glassy pinnacles disappearing into the clouds. I didn't know it was the Royal Palace, any more than I knew the remains of the letters had once spelled out Galleon Road, but I thought it was very likely. Just when I began to think we'd have to push on and get drenched, the rain let up a little. I checked to make sure radar was covered, nothing sticking out of the blanket but the end of her snout and her back paws, then mounted up and pedaled slowly across the dry channel. As we did, I wondered if I was crossing the Rumpa Bridge Woody had told me about. 9. The shops were fancy, but something was wrong about them. It wasn't just that they were deserted or obvious that at some time in the distant past they had been looted, perhaps by Lillimar residents fleeing their city when the Grey came. There was something else that was more subtle. and more awful because it was still there, still happening. The buildings seemed solid enough, vandalized or not, but they were twisted somehow, as if a gigantic force had pulled them out of shape and they hadn't been able to entirely snap back. When I looked directly at them, His Majesty's Bootery, Culinary Delights, Curious Treasures, Tailors to the House of... The rest of that one had been beaten away, as if what followed were profane. Spokes and Wheels. They seemed okay. Normal enough, if anything could be said to be normal in the otherworldliness of the other. But when I returned to minding my straight path down the wide street, something happened to them at the edge of my vision. Straight angles seemed to slither into curves. Glassless windows seemed to move like eyes squinting for a better look at me. Letters became runes. I told myself this was nothing but my hopped-up imagination, but I couldn't be sure. One thing I was sure of, I didn't want to be here after dark. At one cross street, a huge stone gargoyle had tumbled into the street and stared at me upside down, with its lipless mouth stretched open to show a pair of reptilian fangs and a pitted gray tongue. I made a wide arc around it, relieved to get past its chilly upside-down gaze. As I moved on, there was a low thud. I looked back and saw the gargoyle had fallen over. Maybe one of the back wheels of the trike had brushed it, upsetting the precarious balance it had maintained for years? Maybe not. Either way, it was staring at me again. 10. The palace, assuming that was what it was, grew closer. The buildings on either side looked like townhouses, once no doubt luxurious, but now falling to ruin. Balconies had collapsed. Carriage lamps marking fancy stone walks had either fallen over or been knocked down. The walks themselves were sprouting brownish-gray weeds that looked nasty. The spaces between these stone houses had been choked with nettles. Going through would tear your skin to ribbons. The rain started to come down heavily again as we reached even fancier houses, these constructed of marble and glass, with wide steps intact, and fancy porticos, mostly smashed. I told Radar to hang in there, we had to be getting close, but I did it in a low voice. In spite of the downpour, my mouth was dry. I never even considered turning it up to catch some rain because I didn't know what might be in it or what it would do to me. This was a terrible place. An infection had run through it, and I didn't want to drink any of it down. Yet it seemed to me there was one good thing. Claudia had told me I might get lost, but so far it had been a straight shot. If Hannah's yellow house and the sundial were near the majestic agglomeration of buildings overlooked by the three spires, Galleon Road would take me directly there. Now I could see vast windows in that great pile. They weren't stained glass like those in a cathedral, but a shimmering, deep green that reminded me of the staves in the outer gate and that nasty pool. Looking at them, I almost missed Mr. Bowditch's initials, painted halfway up a stone post with a ring bolt on top, presumably for hitching horses. There was a row of these, like blunt teeth, standing in front of a gigantic gray building with almost a dozen doors at the top of its steep steps, but not a single window. The post bearing the initials AB was the last in line before a narrower street branching off to the left. The crossbar of the letter A had been turned into an arrow that pointed down this narrow way, which was lined with more faceless stone buildings, hulking 8 or 10 stories high. I could imagine that once these had been filled with empressarian bureaucrats doing the work of the kingdom. I could almost see them scurrying in and out, wearing long black frock coats and shirts with high collars, like men, I guess they would all be men, in the illustrations of a Dickens novel. I didn't know if any of the buildings housed His Majesty's royal prison, but in a way they all looked like prisons to me. I stopped, staring at the A crossbar that had been turned into an arrow. The palace was dead ahead, but the arrow was pointing me away from it. The question was this: did I keep on going straight, or did I follow the arrow? From behind me, in the basket and under a blanket that was now wet and would soon be soaking, Radar had another coughing fit. I almost disregarded the arrow and went straight on, figuring I could always come back if I ran into a dead end or something, but then I remembered two things Claudia had told me. One was that if I followed Mr. Bowditch's marks, all would be well. Might be well is what she actually said, but why quibble? The other was that I had, according to her, a goddamned long trek ahead of me. But if I continued the way I was going, it would be a goddamned short trek. In the end, I decided to trust Claudia and Mr. Bowditch. I turned the trike in the direction the arrow pointed and pedaled on. "The streets are a maze," Claudia told me. She was right about that. And Mr. Bowditch's initials, his marks, took me ever deeper into it. New York made sense. Chicago made a degree of sense. Lillimar made no sense at all. I imagined it was the way London must have been during the time of Sherlock Holmes and Jack the Ripper. For all I know, it's that way now. Some of the streets were wide and lined with leafless trees that gave no shelter from the rain. Some were narrow, one so skinny that the three-wheeler barely fit. On that one, we got some relief from the pelting rain, at least, because double-decker buildings hung over the street, almost touching. Sometimes there were trolley wires, a few still hanging down in tensionless swags, most lying in the street. In one window, I saw a headless dressmaker's dummy with a jester's cap and bells on its neck and a knife planted between its breasts. If that was someone's idea of a joke, it wasn't funny. After the first hour, I had no idea how many rights and lefts I'd taken. At one point, I went through a dripping underpass where the sound of the trike's wheels splashing through standing water sent back echoes that sounded like whispered laughter. Some of his marks, the ones out in the weather, were so faded they were hard to see. If I lost the trail they made, I'd have to retrace my course or try to take a bearing from the three spires of what I assumed was the palace, and I didn't know if I could do that. For long stretches, the buildings crowding in on me blotted it out entirely. It was all too easy to imagine myself blundering through this snarl of streets until the two bells, and then the evening three, and then having to worry about the night soldiers. Only in this rain, and with the steady coughing from behind me, I thought by nightfall Radar would be dead. Twice I passed gaping holes that slanted down into darkness. From these there wafted drafts of ill-smelling air, and what sounded like those whispering voices Claudia had warned me about. The smell from the second one was stronger, the whispering louder. I didn't want to imagine terrified city dwellers taking refuge in vast underground bunkers and dying there, but it was hard not to. Impossible, really. Just as it was impossible to believe those whispering voices were anything but the voices of their ghosts. I didn't want to be here. I wanted to be home in my sane world, where the only disembodied voices came out of my ear pods. I came to a corner with what might have been Mr. Bowditch's initials on a lamppost, or just a swatch of old blood. I got off the three-wheeler for a closer look. Yes, it was his mark, but almost gone. I didn't dare wipe the water and grime from it for fear of erasing it entirely, so I bent until my nose was almost touching it. The crossbar of the A pointed right. I was sure of it. Almost sure. As I went back to the trike, Radar poked her head out of the blanket and whined. One of her eyes was glued shut with ooze. The other was at half-mast but looking behind us. I looked that way and heard a footstep, for sure, this time, and caught a flash of movement that could have been a bit of clothing, a cloak, maybe, as its wearer stepped around another corner a few streets back.
"Who's there?"
I called, then clapped my hands over my mouth.
Quiet, be quiet. Everyone I'd met had told me that.
In a much lower voice, almost a shouted whisper, I added,
"Show yourself. If you're a friend, I can be a friend."
No one showed himself. I hadn't really expected them to. I dropped my hand to the butt of Mr. Bodich's revolver.
"If you're not, I have a gun and I'll use it if I have to."
Pure bluff. I'd been warned about that, too, and strongly.
"Do you hear me? For your sake, stranger, I hope you do."
I didn't exactly sound like myself, and not for the first time. I sounded more like a character in a book or a movie. I almost expected to hear myself say,
"My name is Inigo Montoya. You killed my father. Prepare to die."
Radar was coughing again, and she had started to shiver. I got back on the trike and pedaled in the direction the latest arrow pointed. It led me onto a zigzagging street, paved with cobblestones, and for some reason lined with barrels, many of them overturned. 11. I continued to follow the initials, a few almost as bright as the day he put them there in red paint. Most faded to ghosts of their former selves. Left and right, right and left. I saw no bodies or skeletons of the long departed, but I smelled rot almost everywhere, and occasionally there was that sense of the building slyly changing their shapes. I rode through puddles in places. In others, the streets had flooded completely, and the trike's big wheels ran through the murk almost hubcap deep. The rain diminished to a drizzle, then stopped. I had no clue as to how far I was from Hannah's yellow house. With no phone to consult and no sun in the sky, my sense of time was completely fucked. I kept expecting the two midday bells to ring out.
"Lost," I thought. "I am lost. I have no GPS, and I'll never get there in time. I'll be lucky to get out of this crazy place before dark."
Then I crossed a little square with a statue in the middle. It was of a woman with her head swatted off, and realized I could see the three spires again. Only now I was looking at them from the side. I had an idea then, and it came to me, absurd but true, in the voice of Coach Harkness, who coached basketball as well as baseball. Coach Harkness striding up and down the sidelines, red in the face, and with big patches of sweat showing at the armpits of the white shirt he always wore on game nights, following the flow of his team and screaming,
back door, damn it!"
Back door. That was where Mr. Bodich's trail of initials was leading me, not to the front of that enormous central building, where Galleon Road no doubt ended, behind it. I crossed the square to the left, expecting to find his initials on one of the three streets leading away from it, and so I did, painted on the side of a shattered glass building that might once have been a greenhouse of some kind. Now the side of the palace was on my right, and, yes, the marks led me further and further around. I began to see a high, curving shoulder of stonework behind the sprawl of the main buildings. I pedaled faster. The next mark pointed me to the right, along what must have been, in better days, a wide boulevard. Back then, it might have been fancy-schmancy, but now the pavement was cracked and crumbled away to gravel in some places. An overgrown median ran down the center. Among the weeds were enormous flowers with yellow petals and deep green centers. I slowed long enough to look at one that overhung the street on its long stem, but when I reached toward it, the petals closed with a snap inches from my fingers. Some white, sappy fluid drooled out. I could feel heat. I pulled my hand back in a hurry. Further along, maybe a quarter of a mile, I saw three looming roof peaks, one on either side of the boulevard I was now traveling, and one that appeared to be right over it. They were the same yellow as the hungry flowers. Directly ahead of me, the boulevard debouched into another square with a dry fountain in the center of it. It was huge and green, with random obsidian cracks running through its bowl. "Write it down, Prince Charlie," had been Claudia's constant scripture, and I checked the notes I'd taken just to be sure. Dry fountain, check. Huge yellow house straddling the road, check. Hide, double check. I stuffed the sheet of paper into the side pocket of my pack to keep it from getting wet. Didn't even think about it at the time, but later on, I had reason to be grateful it was in there instead of my pocket. Ditto my phone. I rode slowly to the square, then more quickly to the fountain. Its pedestal was easily 8 feet high and as thick as a tree trunk. Good cover. I dismounted and peeked around the pedestal. Ahead of me, no more than 50 yards from the fountain, was Hannah's house. Or houses. They were connected by a yellow-painted corridor over the central passageway, sort of like the skyways you see all over Minneapolis. Quite the abode, all in all. And Hannah was outside. Chapter 18. Hannah. Pinwheel paths. The horror in the pool. The sundial at last. An unwelcome encounter. 1. Hannah must have come out when the rain stopped, perhaps to savor the brightening day. She was sitting on an enormous golden throne below a striped awning of red and blue. I didn't think the gold was just plating, and I very much doubted that the jewels crusting the throne's back and arms were paste. I thought the king and or queen of Empis would have looked ridiculously small when perched upon it, but Hannah not only filled it, her enormous bottom squeezed out on the sides between the golden arms and the royal purple cushions. The woman on that stolen, I had no doubt of it, throne was nightmarishly ugly. From where I had taken cover behind the dry fountain, it was impossible to tell how big she really was, but I'm 6'4", and it looked to me as if she'd tower over me by another 5 feet, even sitting down. If so, that meant Hannah would be at least 20 feet tall when standing. An authentic giant, in other words. She was wearing a circus tent of a dress, the same royal purple as the cushions she was sitting on. It came down to her tree-trunk calves. Her fingers, each looked nearly as big as my hand, were dressed in many rings. They glimmered in the subdued daylight. If the day brightened more, they'd flash fire. Dark brown hair fell to her shoulders and onto the tidal wave of her bosom in clumpy snarls. The dress announced her as female, but otherwise it would have been hard to tell. Her face was a mass of lumps and large infected boils. A red-rimmed crack ran down the center of her forehead. One eye squinted, the other bulged. Her upper lip rose to her gnarled nose, revealing teeth that had been filed into fangs. Worst of all, the throne was surrounded by a semicircle of bones that were almost certainly human. Radar began to cough. I turned to her, put my head down next to hers, and looked into her eyes. "Hush, girl,"
I whispered.
Please, be quiet.
She coughed again, then fell silent. She was still shivering. I started to turn away, and the coughing started again, louder than ever. I think we would have been discovered if Hannah hadn't chosen that moment to break into song.
Stick a sticker, show my love. Stick it where it goes, my love. Stick a sticker all night long. Stick me with your prong-dee-dong. Prong-dee-dong, oh, prong-dee-dong. Stick me with your prong-dee-dong.
I had an idea that probably wasn't from the Brothers Grimm. She went on. It seemed to be one of those songs like 100 Bottles of Beer that has a zillion verses, and that was perfectly fine with me because Radar was still coughing. I stroked her chest and belly trying to ease her as Hannah bellowed something about Joe my dear and have no fear. I half expected stick it in my rear. I was still stroking and Hannah was still bellowing when the midday bells rang. This close to the palace, they were deafening. The sound rolled away. I waited for Hannah to get up and go into her kitchen. She didn't. Instead, she pressed two of her fingers against a boil on her shovel-sized chin and squeezed. Out came a gusher of yellowish pus. She wiped it up with the heel of her hand, examined it, and flung it into the street. Then she settled back. I waited for Radar to start coughing again. She didn't, but she would. It was only a matter of time.
Sing, I thought. Sing, you great ugly bitch, before my dog starts coughing again and our bones wind up with the ones you're too fucking lazy to pick up.
But instead of singing, she got to her feet. It was like watching a mountain rise up. I had used a simple ratio I'd learned in math class to figure her standing height, but I'd underestimated the length of her legs. The passage between the two halves of her house had to be 20 feet high, but Hannah would have to bend to go through it. When she was on her feet, she pulled her dress out of the crack of her ass and let loose with a resounding fart that went on and on. It reminded me of the trombone break in my dad's favorite instrumental, Midnight in Moscow. I had to clap my hands over my mouth to keep from braying laughter. Not caring if it started a coughing fit or not, I buried my face in the wet fur on Radar's side and gave vent to a burst of low gasping. I closed my eyes, waiting for Radar to start up again or for one of Hannah's enormous hands to close around my throat and twist my head right off my neck. It didn't happen, so I peered around the other side of the fountain's pedestal in time to see Hannah thump her way to the right side of her house. The size of her was hallucinatory. She could have looked in the upstairs windows with no trouble at all. She opened the oversized door, and the aroma of cooking meat came out. It smelled like roast pork, but I had a horrible feeling pork wasn't what it was. She bent down and went in.
Feed me, you cockless bastard, she thundered. I be hungry.
That's when you must move, Claudia had said. Something like that, anyway. I mounted the three-wheeler and pedaled for the passageway, bent over the handlebars like a guy in the last kilometer of the Tour de France. Before I entered it, I took a quick glance to my left, where the throne was. The cast-off bones were small, almost certainly the bones of children. There was gristle on some and hair on others. Looking was a mistake, one I would have taken back if I could, but sometimes, all too often, we can't help ourselves, can we? 2. The passageway was about 80 feet long, cool and damp, lined with mossy blocks of stone. The light at the other end was brilliant, and I thought when I came out in the plaza I might actually see the sun.
No. Just as I exited the passageway, bent over the handlebars, the clouds swallowed up the brave little patch of blue, and shadeless gray returned. What I saw stopped me cold. My feet fell off the pedals, and the three-wheeler coasted to a stop. I was on the edge of a great open plaza. Eight ways curved in from eight different directions. Once their paving had been brightly colored, green, blue, magenta, indigo, red, pink, yellow, orange. Now the colors were fading. I supposed they would eventually be as gray as everything else in Lillimar, and so much of Empus beyond. Looking at those curving ways was like looking at a gigantic, once jolly pinwheel. Bordering the curving pathways were poles bedecked with pennants. Years ago, how many, they might have snapped and fluttered in breezes untainted by the scent of rot and decay. Now they hung limp and dribbling rainwater. At the center of this enormous pinwheel was another butterfly statue with the wings and head destroyed. The shattered remnants were heaped around the pedestal on which it stood. Beyond, a wider way led toward the back of the palace with its three dark green spires. I could imagine the people, the empressarians, who had once filled those curving ways, merging their separate groups into one single throng, laughing and shoving good-naturedly, anticipating an impending entertainment, some carrying lunches in hampers or baskets, some stopping to buy from food sellers hawking their wares. Souvenirs for the little ones? Pennants, of course. I tell you, I could see this as if I had been there myself. And why not? I had been part of such crowds on special nights to see the White Sox, and on one never-to-be-forgotten Sunday, the Chicago Bears. Bulking above the back of the palace, this part of the palace, it sprawled everywhere, I could see a curved rampart of red stone. It was lined with tall poles, each topped with long tray-like devices. Games had been played here, eagerly observed by masses of people, I was sure of it. Crowds had roared. Now, the curving walkways and the main entryway were empty and as haunted as the rest of this haunted city. In our fifth grade history mod, my class had built a castle from Lego blocks. It seemed like play rather than learning to us then, but in retrospect, it was learning after all. I still remembered most of the various architectural elements, and I saw some of them as I approached. Flying buttresses, turrets, battlements, parapets, even what might have been a postern gate. But like everything else in Lillimar, it was wrong. Staircases ran crazily and pointlessly, so far as I could tell, into and around strange toadstool-shaped excrescences with slitted glassless windows. They might have been guard posts, they might have been God knows what. Some of the stairways crisscrossed, reminding me of those Escher drawings where your eyes keep fooling you. I blinked and the staircases looked upside down. Blinked again, and they were right side up. Worse, the entire place, which had absolutely no symmetry, seemed to be moving, like Howl's Castle. I couldn't exactly see it happening, because it was hard to hold the entire thing in my eyes, or my mind. The stairs were in various colors, like the pinwheel paths, which probably sounds cheery, but the overall feeling was one of some unknowable sentience. As if it wasn't a palace at all, but a thinking creature with an alien brain. I knew my imagination was running away with me. No, I didn't know that. But I was very glad Mr. Bowditch's marks had brought me around to the stadium side, so those cathedral windows couldn't stare directly down at me. I'm not sure I could have borne their green gaze. I pedaled slowly along the wide entryway path, the wheels of the trike sometimes thumping over blocks that had been pushed out of true. The back of the palace was mostly blind stone. There was a series of large red doors, 8 or 9, and an ancient traffic jam of wagons, more than a few overturned and a couple smashed to pieces. It was easy to imagine Hannah doing that, maybe out of anger, maybe just for sport. I thought this was a supply area the rich and royal saw seldom, if ever. This was the way the common folk came. I spied Mr. Bowditch's faded initials on one of the stone blocks close to this loading and unloading area. I didn't like being that close to the palace, even on its blind side, because I could almost see it moving, pulsing. The crossbar of the A pointed left, so I diverted from the main way to follow the arrow. Radar was coughing again and hard. When I'd put my face against her fur to stifle my laughter, it had been wet and cold and matted. Could dogs get pneumonia? I decided that was a stupid question. Probably any creature with lungs could get it. More initials led me to a line of 6 or 8 flying buttresses. I could have gone under them, but chose not to. They were the same dark green as the tower windows, maybe not stone at all, but some kind of glass. Hard to believe glass could provide the tremendous weight-bearing load such a huge rearing edifice would require, but glass was what it looked like. And once again, I saw black tendrils inside, lazily writhing around each other as they slowly rose and sank. Looking at the buttresses was like looking at a line of strange green and black lava lamps. Those writhing black tendrils made me think of several horror movies. Alien was one, Piranha was another, and I wished I had never watched them. I was starting to think I was going to make a full circuit of the palace, which would mean falling under the triple gaze of those spires, when I came to an alcove. It was between 2 windowless wings that spread apart in a V. There were benches here, surrounding a little pool that was shaded by palm trees. Crazy, but true. The palms obscured what lay deeper in this alcove, but rearing above them, at least 100 feet high, was a pole topped by a stylized sun. It had a face, and the eyes moved back and forth like the tick-tocking eyes of a Kit Kat clock. To the right of the pool, Mr. Bowditch had painted his initials on a stone block. The crossbar of this A didn't have an arrow. This time the arrow jutted from the apex. I could almost hear Mr. Bowditch saying,
"Straight ahead, Charlie, and don't waste time."
"Hang on, Raids, almost there."
I pedaled in the direction the arrow pointed. It took me to the right of the pretty little pool. There was no need to stop and peer into it from between 2 of the palms, not when what I'd come for was so close. But I did. And, as terrible as what I saw there was, I'm glad. It changed everything. Although, it would be a long time before I fully understood the crucial importance of that moment. Sometimes we look because we have to remember. Sometimes the most horrible things are what give us strength. I know that now, but at the time, all I could think was, "Oh my dear God, it's Ariel." Lying in that pool, once perhaps a soothing blue but now turned silty and dim with decomposition, were the remains of a mermaid. But not Ariel, the Disney princess daughter of King Triton and Queen Athena. No, not her. Most certainly not her. There was no sparkly green tail, no blue eyes, no billow of red hair, no cute little purple bra top either. I thought this mermaid had once been blonde, but most of her hair had fallen out and floated on top of the pool. Her tail might once have been green, but now it was a stupid, lifeless gray, like her skin.
Her lips were gone, revealing a ring of small teeth. Her eyes were empty sockets. Yet once she had been beautiful. I was as sure of that as I was of the happy throngs that had once come here to see games or entertainments. Beautiful and alive and full of happy, harmless magic. Once she had swum here. It had been her home, and the people who had taken time to come to this pocket oasis had seen her. She had seen them, and both had been refreshed. Now she was dead, with an iron shaft protruding from the place where her fish tail became a human torso, and a coil of gray guts bulged from the hole. Only a whisper of her beauty and grace remained. She was as dead as any fish that ever died in an aquarium and floated there with all its lively colors faded. She was an ugly corpse, partially preserved by cold water, while a truly ugly creature, Hannah, still lived and sang and farted and ate her noxious food. Cursed, I thought, all cursed. Evil has fallen on this unlucky land. That was not a Charlie Reed thought, but it was a true thought. I felt hate for Hannah rise up in me, not because she had killed the little mermaid, I thought the giant would have simply torn her to shreds, but because she, Hannah, was alive and would be in my way going back. Radar began coughing again, so hard I could hear the basket creak behind me. I broke the spell of that pathetic corpse and pedaled around the pool and toward the pole with the sun atop it. 3. The sundial filled the part of the alcove where the V of the two wings narrowed. Before it was a sign on an iron pole. Faded but still legible, it said, "All keep out." The disc looked to be 20 feet in diameter, which made it, if my math was right, about 60 feet in circumference. I saw Mr. Bowditch's initials on the far side. I wanted a good look at them. They had guided me here. Now that I was, those last ones might tell me the right direction to turn the sundial. It wasn't possible to ride Claudia's three-wheeler across because the sundial circle was rimmed with short black and white pickets about 3 feet high. Radar coughed, choked, and coughed some more. She was panting and shivering, one eye gummed shut, the other looking at me. Her fur was matted against her body, letting me see, not that I wanted to, how pitifully thin she'd become, almost skeletal. I dismounted the trike and lifted her out of the basket. Her shivering against me was convulsive, shudder and relax, shudder and relax.
"Soon, girl, soon."
Hoping I was right, because this was her only chance. And it had worked for Mr. Bowditch, hadn't it? But even after the giant and the mermaid, I found it hard to believe. I stepped over the pickets and walked across the sundial. It was stone and divided into 14 pie wedges. Now I think I know how long the days are here, I thought. A simple symbol, worn but still recognizable, was engraved in the center of each wedge. The two moons, the sun, a fish, a bird, a pig, an ox, a butterfly, a bee, a sheaf of wheat, a bundle of berries, a drop of water, a tree, a naked man, and a naked woman who was pregnant. Symbols of life. And as I passed beside the high pole in the center, I could hear the click, 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 click of the eyes in the sun's face as they went back and forth, ticking time away. I stepped over the short pickets on the far side, still holding Radar against me. Her tongue hung limply from the side of her mouth as she coughed relentlessly. Her time had grown short indeed.
I faced the sundial and Mr. Bowditch's initials. The crossbar of the A had been turned into a slightly curved arrow pointing to the right, which meant that when I turned the sundial, if I could, it would be moving counterclockwise. That seemed correct. I hoped so. If it was wrong, I would have come all this way just to kill my dog by making her even older. I heard whispering voices and paid them no mind. Radar was all I was thinking about, just her, and I knew what had to be done. I bent and gently laid her on the wedge engraved with the sheaf of wheat. She tried to raise her head, but couldn't. She laid it sideways on the stone between her paws, looking at me with her one good eye. Now she was too weak to cough and could only wheeze. Let this be right, and God, please let it work. I knelt and grasped one of the short rods ringing the sundial's circumference. I pulled on it with one hand, then both. Nothing happened. Radar was now making choking sounds between gasps for air. Her side went up and down like a bellows. I pulled harder. Nothing. I thought of football practice and how I'd been the only one on the team not just able to move the tackling dummy, but to knock it over. Pull, you son of a bitch, pull for her life. I gave it everything I had. Legs, back, arms, shoulders. I could feel blood rushing up my straining neck and into my head. I was supposed to be quiet in Lillimar, but I couldn't restrain a low, growling grunt of effort. Had Mr. Bowditch been able to do this? I didn't see how. Just when I thought I still wasn't going to be able to budge it, I felt the first minuscule shift to the right. I couldn't possibly pull harder, but somehow I did, every muscle in my arms, back, and neck standing out. The sundial began to move. Instead of being directly in front of me, my dog was now a little to my right. I shifted my weight the other way and started pushing for all I was worth. I thought of Claudia telling me to strain my pooper. I was straining it now for sure, probably on the verge of turning the poor thing inside out. Once I had it started, the wheel turned more easily. The first picket was beyond me, so I grabbed another, shifted my weight again, and pulled on it as hard as I could. When that one slipped past, I grabbed yet another. It made me think of the play merry-go-round in Cavanaugh Park, and how Bertie and I used to spin it until the little kids riding on it were screaming in joy and terror, and their mothers were yelling at us to stop before one of them flew off. Radar was a third of the way around, then half, then on her way back to me. The sundial was spinning easily now. Perhaps some ancient grease clog in the machinery beneath it had been broken, but I kept yanking on those pickets, now going hand over hand as if climbing a rope. I thought I was seeing a change in Radar, but believed it might be only wishful thinking, until the sundial brought her all the way back to me. Both of her eyes were open. She was coughing, but the horrible wheezing had stopped, and her head was up. The sundial moved faster, and I quit pulling at the pickets. I watched Radar on her second circuit and saw her trying to rise on her front paws. Her ears were up instead of flopping dispiritedly. I squatted, breathing hard, my shirt damp against my chest and sides, trying to figure out how many turns would be enough. I realized I still didn't know how old she was. 14, maybe even 15? If each circuit equaled a year, 4 turns on the sundial would be good. 6 would put her back in the prime of life. When she passed me, I saw she wasn't just propping herself on her front legs, she was sitting up. And as she came around for the third time, I saw something I could hardly credit. Raids was filling out, putting on weight. She wasn't yet the dog who had scared the shit out of Andy Chen, but she was getting there. Only one thing bothered me. Even without me yanking on the short posts, the sundial was still picking up speed. The fourth time around, I thought Radar looked worried. The fifth time, she looked scared, and the wind of her passage blew the sweat-soaked hair off my forehead. I had to get her off. If I didn't, I'd be treated to the sight of my dog becoming a puppy, and then nothing. Overhead, the click-click-click-click of the sunface's eyes had become click-click-click-click, and I knew that if I looked up, I'd see its eyes going left and right faster and faster until they were just a blur. Amazing things can go through your mind in times of extreme stress. I flashed on a Turner Classic Movies Western I'd seen with my dad back in his drinking days. Pony Express, it was called. What I remembered was Charlton Heston galloping hell for leather toward a lonely outpost where a bag of mail hung on a hook. Charlton snatched it without ever slowing his horse from its all-out gallop, and I was going to have to snatch radar the same way. I didn't want to shout, so I got into a crouch and held my arms out, hoping she'd understand. When the sundial came around and she saw me, she got to her feet. The wind of the speeding disc rippled her fur like invisible stroking hands. If I missed her, Charlton Heston hadn't missed the mailbag, but that was a movie, I'd have to jump on myself, grab her, and jump off. I might lose one of my 17 years in the process, but sometimes desperate measures are the only measures. As it happened, I didn't have to grab her at all. When I put her on the sundial, Raids couldn't have even walked on her own. After 5 going on 6 turns on it, she was an entirely different dog. She dropped to her haunches, flexed newly powerful back legs, and leaped into my outstretched arms. It was like being hit with a flying bag of concrete. I fell over on my back, with radar over me, forepaws planted wide on either side of my shoulders, wagging her tail like crazy and licking my face. "Stop it," I whispered. But the command didn't have much force because I was laughing. She went on licking. At last, I sat up and took a good look at her. She had been down to 60 pounds, maybe less. Now she had to go 80 or 90. The wheezing and coughing were gone. The rheum drying on her snout was also gone, as if it had never been there. The white had disappeared both from her snout and the black saddle of fur on her back. Her tail, which had been a tattered flag, was bushy and full as it swished back and forth. Best of all, the surest indicator of the change the sundial had wrought, were her eyes. They were no longer filmy and dazed, as if she didn't know exactly what was going on within her or in the outside world around her.
"Look at you," I whispered.
I had to wipe my eyes.
"Just look at you."
4. I hugged her, then stood up. The thought of finding the gold pellets never crossed my mind. I'd tempted fate enough for one day. More than enough. There was no way this new and improved version of radar would fit in the basket on the back of the three-wheeler. One look was enough to convince me of that. Nor did I have her leash. That was back at Claudia's house, in Dora's cart. I think part of me must have believed I'd never need such a thing again. I bent, put my hands on the sides of her face, and looked into her dark brown eyes.
"Stay with me, and be quiet. Hush, Raids."
We went back the way we came, me pedaling, radar padding along beside me. I made it a point not to look in the pool. As we neared the stone passageway, the rain began again. Halfway along the passage, I stopped and dismounted the trike. I told Radar to sit and stay. Moving slowly, keeping my back to the passageway's moss-coated side, I slid to the end. Radar watched but didn't move. Good dog. I stopped when I could see the golden arm of that grotesquely over-decorated throne. I took another step, craned my neck, and saw it was empty. Rain pattered down on the striped canopy. Where was Hannah? Which side of the two-part house, and what was she doing? Questions for which I had no answer. She might still be eating her midday meal of stuff that smelled like pork but probably wasn't, or she might have already gone back to her living quarters for her afternoon nap. I didn't think we'd been gone long enough for me to assume she'd finished eating, but that was only a guess. The last little while, first the mermaid, then the sundial, had been intense. From where I stood, I could see the dry fountain dead ahead. It would give us good cover, but only if we were unobserved until we got there. Just 50 yards, But when I imagined the consequences of being caught out in the open, it seemed a lot further. I listened for Hannah's bellowing voice, louder even than Claudia's, and didn't hear it. A few verses of the Prong De Dong song would have come in handy for pinpointing her location, but here's something I learned in the haunted city of Lillimar. Giants never sing when you want them to. Nevertheless, a choice had to be made, and mine was to try for the fountain. I went back to radar and was about to mount up on the trike when there was a loud slam to the left of the passageway's end. Radar started and turned that way, a low snarl beginning deep in her chest. I grabbed her before it could morph into a volley of barks and bent down.
Quiet, Radar, hush!
I heard Hannah muttering, something I couldn't make out, and there was another of those great ripping farts. This one didn't make me feel like laughing, because she was walking slowly across the entrance to the passageway. If she looked to her right, Radar and I could stand against the wall and maybe, in the dimness, go unobserved, but even if Hannah were nearsighted, Claudia's three-wheeler was too big to miss. I drew Mr. Bowditch's revolver and held it by my side. If she turned our way, I was going to shoot her, and I knew exactly what I was going to aim for, that red-rimmed crack running down the center of her forehead. I'd never practiced with Mr. Bowditch's gun, or any gun, but my eyes were good. I might miss the first time, but I'd have four more chances even if I did. As for the noise, I thought of those bones scattered around the throne and thought, fuck the noise. She never looked our way, or toward the fountain, either, only stared at her feet and went on muttering in a way that reminded me of Dad before he had to make a speech at the Overland National Insurance annual dinner when he won Regional Employee of the Year. There was something in her left hand, but her hip mostly blocked it until she raised it to her mouth. She was gone from sight before she could bite into it, which was fine by me. I'm pretty sure it was a foot, and that there was already a crescent-shaped bite in one side, below the ankle. I was afraid she might settle back onto the throne to polish off her after-lunch treat, but apparently the rain, even with the canopy to shield her, discouraged that idea. Or maybe she just wanted her nap. Either way, there was the slam of another door, this one to our right, then silence. I holstered the gun and sat down next to my dog. Even in the dimness, I could see how good Radar looked, how young and strong. I was glad. Maybe that seems like a tame word to you, but it doesn't to me. I think gladness is a big, big deal. I couldn't keep my hands off her fur and marveling at how dense it was. 5. I didn't want to wait. All I wanted was to get the hell out of Lillimar with my renewed dog and take her into that supply shed and watch her eat as much as she could. I was betting that would be a lot. I'd give her a whole jar of Origin if she wanted, and a couple of perky jerky sticks to top it off. Then we could watch the monarchs return to their roosting places. That was what I wanted, but I made myself wait and give Hannah a chance to settle down. I counted to 500 by tens, then fives, then twos. I didn't know if that was time enough for the oversized bitch to get into full snooze mode, but I couldn't wait any longer. Getting out of her vicinity was important, but I also had to be out of the city by dark, and not just because of the night soldiers. Some of Mr. Bowditch's marks were very faded, and if I lost his trail, I'd be in bad trouble.
Come on, I told Radar. But hush, girl, hush.
I pulled the trike, wanting to have it behind me if Hannah suddenly emerged and attacked. While she was swiping it out of the way, I might have time to draw and fire. Plus there was Radar, who was back to her fighting weight. I had an idea that if Hannah messed with raids, she was going to lose some flesh. That, I thought, would be a pleasant sight to see. Seeing Hannah break Radar's neck with one swipe of her enormous hand, however, wouldn't be pleasant at all. I paused at the mouth of the passageway, then started for the fountain with radar beside me. There were games, particularly against our chief rival St. John's, that never seemed to end, but the walk in the open between Hannah's house and the dry fountain in the square were the longest 50 yards of my life. I kept expecting to hear some empisarian version of fee-fi-fo-fum and hear the ground-shaking thud of her running feet as she came after us. A bird squalled, maybe a crow, maybe a buzzard, but that was the only sound. We made it to the fountain, and I leaned against it to wipe a mixture of sweat and rainwater from my face. Radar was looking up at me. No shaking or shivering now, no coughing either. She was grinning, having an adventure. I took another look for Hannah, then mounted up and started pedaling for the fancy divided boulevard, where, once upon a time, the elite folks had no doubt met to eat tea sandwiches and discuss the latest court gossip. Maybe in the evenings there had been empisarian barbecues or lamplit cotillions in big backyards that were now overgrown with weeds, thistles, and dangerous flowers. I went at a pretty good clip, but radar kept up easily, loping along with her tongue flying jauntily from one side of her mouth. The rain was coming down harder, but I barely noticed. All I wanted was to retrace my course and get out of the city. I'd worry about drying off then, and if I caught a cold, I'm sure Claudia would stuff me full of chicken soup before I headed back to Woody's, then Dora's, then home. My father would give me a whole raft of shit, but when he saw radar, he'd what? I decided not to worry about that now. The first job was to get out of this unpleasant city, which wasn't deserted at all, and which wouldn't quite stay still. 6. It should have been easy, simply follow Mr. Bowditch's marks in reverse, going in the opposite direction of each pointing arrow until we got back to the main gate. But when I came to the point where we'd entered the wide boulevard, his initials were gone. I was sure they'd been on a cobblestone in front of a sprawling building with a dirty glass cupola on top, but there wasn't a sign of them.